May it please the court, I'm Larry Hamel, appearing on behalf of the plaintiff in this matter and the appellant. I believe the court is generally familiar with the background of this circumstance, litigation that arises out of a contract that entered into in 1998 led to litigation beginning in 2007. The litigation has already been before this court on one occasion. At that time, the court reversed the trial court, which had held that despite the fact that Premier had prevailed on all claims that it asserted and prevailed against Dr. Weinstein on all the claims that he asserted, that we were not the prevailing party. Obviously, we were the prevailing party in this court's sole rule. The other issue on appeal at that time had to do with the instructions issue. The instructions issue is no longer in this case. The only thing that's in this case is the interpretation of the contract between these two parties. The Court of Appeals, in its modified opinion, remanded the matter to the trial court in Colorado Springs to determine, quote, the plaintiff's Premier's attorney fees and costs, both on trial, at trial and on appeal. There's nothing in that mandate that says that in the discretion of the trial court, you should determine the reasonable attorney's fees. And that is the nut of this case. We have a contract that was entered into by two parties. And that contract is what is at issue today. Nothing more and nothing less.
Mr. Hamel, you are very correct, at least from my perspective. That is the focus of my concern. And I understand I'm going to hit you early, but I'd like to address that up front. Here is my major concern with your argument. I understand that your contract says all, and I understand that your argument is that all means all. But I'm concerned about what effect the Code of Professional Conduct should have upon the trial court in this case.
Well, Your Honor, it's an interesting question because the Code of Professional Conduct obviously is directed toward the conduct of attorneys vis-a-vis their clients. There is nothing in the Code of Professional Responsibility that talks about the obligations of an attorney with respect to enforcing a contract term such as this one. I'll deal with that issue in a moment, if I may. I do not believe that 1.5 of the Code of Professional Responsibility has anything to do with this case. If it does, there are eight components under that rule. The only argument in this case is that one of the components, in fact, not one, but one half of the components, precludes the recovery of these attorney's fees. And that one half of the component is subsection 4 of 1.5A, which talks about the amount at issue and the results achieved. The defendant concentrates only on that one component and only on one half of that component, the results achieved. There is no authority that I have found and none has been cited to the court that would provide that in this case, even though there was nominal recovery, that somehow or another, the plaintiff in this case is not entitled to his attorney's fees under the contract. And I also point out that when we talk about the amount in consideration, and I'm in conflict in case, was well over $3 million, $2 million of which was Dr. Weinstein's claim on his counterclaim. The trial court paid scant attention to that issue. The trial court said that I did consider the fact that there was a counterclaim for $2 million, more or less. And it is for that reason that I gave nominal attorney's fees to the plaintiff. I asked the court, and I would ask this court, what would be the result had there never been a claim in this case, but only the counterclaim? If Dr. Weinstein had sued for the breach of contract and other relevant cases, or excuse me, claims that he asserted, would we have been in a situation having defended against that, where we would have to come in and say, well, we completely prevailed in this lawsuit. We have, in fact. But in that circumstance, would we be precluded from recovering our attorney's fees for defending against that counterclaim? That seems to be the thrust of the trial court's position. That is, that because only nominal damages were awarded to the plaintiff, the fact that it defended successfully a $2 million claim against it, it's really not really wrong.
I would like to go to one, to the rule of professional conduct, if we could, because my concern is that if we don't start looking at attorney fees from the context of reasonableness. That suggests to me that every fee-shifting provision that gets written like this, I mean, what if you came in and proved up $10 million in attorney fees, $20 million in attorney fees, $50 million in attorney fees, and at trial you asked for approximately $3 million, defended against approximately $2 million, and the jury gave you $13.
We did ask for $3 million, Your Honor, if I might correct that record. We asked for something short of $1 million.
Oh, all right, all right. I apologize. And yes, I stand corrected. But isn't there some concern there about where does that end?
I think if there is concern about that, then that concern should be to the Office of Disciplinary Counsel. Because if an attorney comes in and simply loads up his fees in a phony case, then I think that is a matter that would be subject to discipline by the Supreme Court. But I don't think that has to do with asserting a claim for attorney's fees that in this case have been found to be reasonable. There is not one shred of evidence in this case that shows that the attorney's fees as adjusted voluntarily by the plaintiff in this case are unreasonable.
Well, did the court find they were reasonable, or did the court simply say, okay, this is the lodestar figure and we'll start there?
The court did not make a lodestar calculation, specifically said it did not make a lodestar calculation. And there is no evidence that these attorney's fees were unreasonable. In fact, in the context of a contract action, if there is an assertion that these attorney's fees are unreasonable, the burden of proof lies on the defendant to establish a failure to mitigate damages. The defendant presented no evidence that the attorney's fees as such were unreasonable. The gist of the attorney's fee issue was that because you only recovered X dollar, you should have a proportionate reduction. And that simply distorts not only the contract, but it distorts also Rule 1.5, because the court did not consider any of the other elements in Rule 1.5.
Counsel, you say that the results achieved should not be part of the equation, or at least, you know, you're arguing for that. But the contract itself, you're focusing on the all attorney's fees and costs, but before we get to all attorney's fees and costs, it says the prevailing party. So why doesn't that term, prevailing party, incorporate a measure of results achieved? How much of what you wanted did you get, and why was it improper for the trial court to take that into consideration?
Well, this court in the first appeal said that under Spencer Contractors, binding authority on this court, that the amount recovered does not determine who is the prevailing party. We were clearly the prevailing party. That is the law of this case, and it has never been overturned. And it is entirely consistent with Spencer Contractors. And they take that issue and they say, well, you only prevailed to a certain extent, and therefore that should moderate your fees by the amount of 98%. There is no logic to that. We have a contract that was entered into by knowledgeable persons and entities represented by counsel at arm's length. One component of that contract is this attorney's fees provision. Dr. Weinstein, in his case, asserted a right to recover his attorney's fees if he prevailed. We asserted a right to recover our attorney's fees if we prevailed. All of the attorney's fees, same position taken by Dr. Weinstein. We have an arm's length contract between sophisticated people who knew what they were doing and who asserted their rights, the same rights, under the contract. Simple fact is that Dr. Weinstein did not prevail. He lost the lawsuit, hands down. If the jury felt that the only damages that were incurred were the $1 per each claim, that's the jury's problem. We can't argue that that is right or wrong. I disagree with it, of course, because the damages were quite profound. But nonetheless, we're faced with that circumstance. But that should not be used to distort the terms and conditions of the contract. The trial court does not have the authority to revise the terms and conditions of the contract. No court does. The responsibility of a court where you have an unambiguous contract which clearly sets forth the intent of the parties is that contract must be enforced. Otherwise, what is a contract worth? The basic concept of law, in a commercial sense at least, is that we have a freedom to contract. And we don't have a freedom to contract unrestrictedly. But there was nothing in this contract that is against public policy. It certainly is reflective of the party's intent, because they both assert the right to recover these attorney's fees.
Mr. Hamel, I agree with you that the right to contract is broad and should clearly be protected, but you suggested the one exception to it, which is public policy. And the concern here is whether this contract is contrary to public policy.
Why would the contract be contrary to public policy? There's no indication in the record that it's contrary to public policy. The only thing the trial court said was that it beggars logic that the parties really intended to enforce the contract.
What about the testimony of, I believe it was Southern Orthopedics expert who testified that probably 1.5 ought to be involved in the calculation?
And then he may have testified to that. It's certainly something that somebody could consider. But what this court has held and what the Supreme Court has held is when you're dealing with 1.5, you must look at all of the elements of 1.5. One half of one element was shown here, and that is that the jury decided that the damages would be nominal. That's all. There's nothing that would indicate that there was any lack of skill and knowledge of the attorneys. This was a heavily contested, highly briefed and fought over lawsuit that has now gone on for 7 years. The attorney's fees in this case were much more than we've asked for. We have already modified those by reducing by $150,000 those fees that are not clearly applicable to what we call the covered claims. Actually, all of these claims were completely interrelated because they were factually founded on the same principles. Nonetheless, Premier has already reduced his fees by $150,000. Moreover, the trial court reduced the fees further because Dr. Zenos settled with $205,000, which is knocked off. We are not appealing that. What the court did was say, well, because of one half of subsection 4 of 1.5a, the results obtained, not the amount involved. If you read that rule carefully, it says one of the things to consider is the amount involved and the results obtained. The court disregarded the amount involved. As I said, we had a $2 million counterclaim, which we defended. If we were here just on that claim alone, would it be improper for us to get our attorney's fees? I don't believe so, and I know of no authority that's been cited to this court that would so hold. The simple consequence of this is that we have a contract which is reasonable on its face, which clearly sets forth the intention of the parties, both of which attempted to take advantage of this contract in this litigation. The litigation has gone in full course and over again, full course. The attorney's fees have not been established to be unreasonable. None of the other components of 1.5, if it is applicable, would show that this is unreasonable. The attorney's fees in this case were nearly $1 million when we get down to attorney's fees and costs. We're now asking for much less than that. And what we're asking for is the amount that was established by expert testimony as to be reasonable. If you get to reasonable, look at that testimony. Both our witness said that it was reasonable. The other witness, the other expert witness, said he could not determine whether it was reasonable or unreasonable. He had no opinion. So the only evidence unrebutted in this case is that if you're going to look at a level of reasonableness, that these fees were reasonable and should be awarded. To do other than that gives Dr. Weinstein a pass on the fact that he knowingly, willingly, and with malice breached these contracts. That's what the jury found. And if you assess no attorney's fees or $25,000 attorney's fees against Dr. Weinstein, this is a total distortion of the contractual obligation that he undertook and attempted to enforce himself. This court should award us our costs because those were just reduced on the same basis, a percentage basis of ratio. We should get our costs and attorney's fees for this appeal. And we ask that the court remand with the instructions to the court down below, not to reconsider the issue of the attorney's fees, but to amend its order to add additional $570,000 plus the $17,000 in costs and fees that were reduced by the court from the appellate phase. I'd like to reserve my time.
Thank you, counsel. You've got about 50 seconds.
May it please the court, my name is Eric Hall, R number 32028. This court should affirm for three reasons. First, Colorado courts require that fees and costs be reasonable, regardless of the language of the contract or the statute or the rule under which fees or costs are shifted. Colorado courts also direct the courts to apply the Code of Professional Conduct 1.5, Colorado 2001 case, expressly notes that in footnote 4, City of Wheatridge also expressly notes that those 1.5A factors must be considered in determining what is a reasonable amount of fees or costs. The court expressly considered the 1.5. Counsel for Premier just said that the court did not do that. That is incorrect. In the court's order on page 6, lines 5 and 6, the trial court says, I have considered the factors relevant to this case listed in City of Wheatridge versus Cervini at page 1115. Those are the 1.5 factors. Counsel also said that the court gave scant attention to the fact that Premier had defended against Dr. Weinstein's counterclaims. Again, that's also incorrect. On page 7 of the trial court's opinion, it says, Premier's argued, this is line 4 and 5, Premier's argued that I should consider its success in defending against well over $1 million in counterclaims brought by the defendants. I have. And that is a reason to not simply conclude that a few dollars or even no dollars should be awarded to Premier. Again, considering the results obtained, a nominal award obtained at the first trial, and lack of success in the second trial. So again, the trial court expressly considered all the factors of 1.5, expressly made a very careful calculation of what was reasonable under the circumstances, and when the trial court did that, it was following Colorado law, undisputed Colorado law.
Counsel, you referenced that the court stated that it was following City of Wheatridge and explained the factors, but it didn't specifically identify what facts in this case met or didn't meet those factors. Why shouldn't we remand for the court to do a more detailed analysis of each factor?
Your Honor, it did. The trial court's order, which again it read from the bench, goes through the various factors under City of Wheatridge and addresses the ones relevant to this case. And that is precisely what the Colorado courts and courts from around the country direct trial courts to do. It's a 8-page order where it carefully lays out the court's reasoning and again addresses the factors that are relevant here. And the trial court that made these findings was consistent with what the first trial court did. Again, recall in this case, we had two trials, and the first trial judge heard all the facts, eventually concluded that neither side prevailed. But then went on to say, after Premier filed another post-trial motion, that, well, even if he were to go on and consider how much should be awarded, he would have to make the degree of success obtained, the nominal damages awarded, to be one of the paramount considerations. Again, that was a ruling by the first trial judge after looking at the whole case. The second trial judge agreed, but the second trial judge was actually called upon to make the determination, and made the determination reviewing the 1.5 factors. And again, I submit, Your Honor, that if you read the opinion, you'll see that the court did consider all the factors and expressly made the calculations necessary under this case. The Premier's argument is that, again, all means all. Well, again, not even Premier believes that. Premier is not arguing that. They're not arguing for all their attorney's fees and costs. You heard counsel just now. They say they have over $1 million, but they have reduced them substantially because they recognize that would be manifestly unjust. And also contrary to Colorado law.
Pardon me for interrupting, Mr. Hall.
Please.
But let's take a look at that because they can, on their own, they of course can make decisions about how much they want to ask for, right? I mean, lawyers discount their fees all the time. They make such decisions. And in this case, for example, counsel pointed out, we're not going to ask for attorney fees associated with the other defendant's case. So I don't know how compelling that is, but they throw out a figure over $500,000. And at that point, let's say that their argument is all means all at that point. What I'd appreciate you doing is addressing their argument that there's no public policy issue here about the application of Rule 1.5.
Again, Your Honor, that's simply not Colorado law. It's not the law of the country. Every jurisdiction that I have found that looks at this issue requires that fees and costs be reasonable and that courts consider the 1.5 factors. Again, in other states, they might refer to them differently. In other cases, they might refer to a slightly different set of factors. But in all the cases, whether you're looking at the Supreme Court cases of Hensley and Farrar, or you're looking at the Colorado cases like Adjuchaka and the City of Wheatridge, they're all considering a number of factors, and trial courts are supposed to consider them for the public policy reasons that you raise, Your Honor. The courts address the precise issue of, well, wouldn't this be manifestly unjust? Wouldn't we be violating Rule 1 of the Colorado Rules of Civil Procedure, of course, to do justice, to be fair in the application of the rules? Of wouldn't we be violating the court's inherent role of providing justice in our society if we were forced to do something manifestly unjust in awarding fees and costs? And so they reject the position. Every court that has considered it has rejected this position of if the contract says all, if it says a full award, if the statute says all, the current excessive liens statute, 3822.128, says all attorney's fees should be awarded to the victor. But the LSV Incorporated case, this court's case from 1999, says despite the fact that the statute says all, the award must only be reasonable because of the concerns about where you might have attorneys incurring unnecessary costs. You might have, essentially, you will have the tail wagging the dog. You'll have the tail of attorney's fees wagging the dog of what are the meritorious claims. And the facts of this case prove that better than any other case I've read. Because here, after two jury trials, Premier recovered nominal damages, literally nominal damages, $1 on each special verdict form, a total of $6.50 against my client, Dr. Weinstein. And now they come to this court, they came to the lower court asking for $821,000, they come to this court asking for a remand for $571,000. It would be manifestly unfair, and exactly why the public policy rule has been articulated again and again and again, that courts must reduce the fees and costs awards to a reasonable award.
So why isn't it manifestly unfair to your opponent to only get 2% of their fees and costs when a division of this court has already said they prevailed and specifically sent it back so that the trial court could determine an appropriate award? I mean, isn't an award of 2% essentially no award, and the court may be awarded something just so it wouldn't get reversed again?
Well, Your Honor, all the cases split this issue into whether a party is the prevailing party and how much should be awarded. For instance, the Spencer Contractor case, upon which Premier relies so heavily, that's a case all about whether the party was a prevailing party. But at the very last paragraph of the majority opinion of Spencer, it remands for a reasonable attorney's fees award. So even Spencer Contractor, once it gets to the second question of how much should be awarded, recognizes it must be a reasonable award. And the mandate that issued from this court last time was that Premier was the prevailing party. Again, we should all consider, well, what does it really mean for them to prevail when they received $6.50 after two trials? But we call it technical victory, we call it pyrrhic victory, call it whatever you want. They prevailed technically, and so they went back down on the second question. The second question, which was not addressed by this court the first time, which is how much should be awarded. And on that point, again, Colorado law is crystal clear, a reasonable amount must be awarded, and the trial court is supposed to consider all factors in the case. And this court did consider all the relevant factors in this case to come to the conclusion that roughly $29,000 was how much should be awarded to Premier in its fees and costs. But that is three times more than the amount they recovered in total That includes the $10,000 confessed, right? It's 4,000, more than 4,000 times more what they recovered on their disputed claims. And again, Premier cites no case, not a single case, in which someone recovers nominal damages and yet has a court award hundreds of thousands of dollars in attorney fees and costs.
What about your opponent's argument that, well, there was this big counterclaim against our client, and we were successful in fighting that bad? Doesn't that count for more than the trial court gave it credit?
No, Your Honor, it doesn't. And again, on page 7 of the trial court's decision, lines 4 and 5, like I already read, the trial court expressly considered that and said that is part of the overall facts and circumstances test that I'm bound to do as the trial court making this decision. I've considered that. That's the reason why I'm not giving Premier just either no fees at all or nominal fees, but I'm giving them $29,000. And that's entirely appropriate. And the courts that consider these sorts of cases, including, for instance, Farrar is a good example, says that that's exactly what the courts should do. Again, Justice O'Connor's concurrence in Farrar says it very eloquently in saying, if you have a case like this, where you have nominal success, sure, maybe they've prevailed, and under the case law, they've prevailed, but it's a pyrrhic victory, it's a chimerical victory. What's the proper response by the trial court in the second question of how much is appropriate? It's no fees or nominal fees, or at the very least, a serious consideration of, well, given the very limited success, some very limited number. And the trial court here, again, didn't even do that. The trial court here did much more than that. The trial court went through some careful calculations about the appellate phase, about the trial court phase, gave them half their appellate fees, and then reduced the trial court fees, yes, by 98%, but did so based upon the 1.5 factors and making the degree of success a paramount concern, which is exactly what it should have done. The Kaplan case, this court's case, says that the most critical element in deciding how much should be awarded is the degree of success obtained. Again, that's just one of many cases that I've cited saying that. And again, these cases are unanimous in Colorado and around the country. I'll point out another line of cases that are similar to this from the 1950s and 60s, where back then people wrote contracts, and for the attorney's fees provision, they'd say the loser will pay the winner 15% of the award as attorney's fees. Colorado Supreme Court in Rock Roll, 1959, rejected that and said, no, the award has to be reasonable. It can't be based on some arbitrary number. The Rock Roll case was subsequently affirmed, repeated. That same principle was repeated two more times in the Waterman case and the Stevens case, all from the 1960s. All those cases go to the same idea, which is in this case, in this context, public policy demands that courts impose a reasonableness requirement, regardless of what the contract says, regardless of what the statute says, regardless of what the rule says, for a fee-shifting provision. I can give another example, Your Honor. The statutory offer of settlement, which is the cost-shifting provision, that statute says that actual costs will be awarded if you meet the circumstances. There's a whole series of cases from this court and the Colorado Supreme Court that say it's not actual costs, it's reasonable costs under the circumstances. This court and the Colorado Supreme Court has again and again said we must give discretion to the trial courts because they're the ones in the best position to review the entire case. They've heard all the evidence, they've heard the witnesses, they've heard the arguments, and they're the ones that should be making this determination about how much is reasonable. That's what happened. That's precisely what happened in this case. And the award of $29,000 by the trial court here is not an abuse of discretion. I will close, Your Honor, unless you have more questions, by just making that point one more time, which this court made in 2 years ago in 2012 in the Payan case. It said, we can hardly think of a sphere of judicial decision making in which appellate micromanagement has less to recommend it than reviews of fees and costs award. in that paragraph 35 of the Pontiac case. Again, Your Honor, there's been no abuse of discretion here. The trial court did exactly what Colorado court requires in reviewing a host of factors and concluding that this is the reasonable award for this case for Premier Recovery's nominal damages. And so I would ask you that you affirm the trial court's decision. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel, you have 50 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You're welcome.
I'm going to point out two cases. In the Spencer contractor case, the Colorado Supreme Court specifically held that the standards of Hensley versus Eckhart, upon which this defendant relies heavily, will have no application in cases arising from contractual rather than fee-shifting cases, the statutory fee-shifting cases. Also, in Planning Partners versus QED, the court said, and this is quoted in part by the defendant, the latitude of trial courts to make a determination of attorney's fees. The court went on to say that in some scenarios, the trial court's discretion may be circumscribed by the statute or contract arising to the fees. That's this circumstance. We have a contract that circumscribes the capacity of the court to make adjustments to the contractual agreement of the parties. There's nothing in this case that establishes that these fees were unreasonable. There's no evidence whatsoever. In fact, the only evidence is that the fees were reasonable and that the costs were reasonable. The only thing that the trial court did was say, I'm going to apply a 98% reduction because of the nominal damages that were awarded. That is not appropriate and it is not permitted by any of the cases cited.
Pardon me, Mr. Hamill. Pardon me, your time is up.
Oh, thank you, Your Honor. I thought I had 29 seconds.
You were 29 seconds over.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much, counsel. We appreciate your arguments and your briefs. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.